So I want to recall from last time the formula for the L infinity structure that you get when you push down to a subcomplex of a an L infinity algebra, which is homotopy equivalent to the whole complex. So let's recall the setup. So L is an L infinity algebra, and we have M is a complex, and I and J are morphisms of complexes, and if we go by I and back by J, we get the identity of M, whereas if we go in the other direction, we have H yields a contracting homotopy. And finally, there are these side conditions which say that if we do H followed by J, we get zero. I followed by H is 0, and H squared is 0. So, in that context, we get a canonical formula for an L-infinity structure on M, and let me remind you how the formula looks. Roughly speaking, and with all the signs somehow left a little up in the air, it's a sum over trees with n leaves labeled 1 up to n. I should say rooted trees. And then the formula involves we apply I to each of the arguments, x1 up to xn, and then we insert them into these operations which are obtained. Everywhere we have a vertex in the tree, we take the corresponding operation in L, and there, after we've performed this shift, remember the brace version of the operations is graded symmetric, and so we've got rid of the problem of how to interpret the order of the branches in a tree. It doesn't matter because these operations are all graded symmetric. And then on each edge we place H. Operation formed by replacing each vertex of tree by the corresponding operation of L. I just realized, actually, I was placing the operations upstairs, which one I'm talking about, and each edge by H. So now I want to go a little further in this direction with this explicit formula and explain a little about maps of L infinity algebras. So there isn't, let me use this board. So there's a very useful notion of a morphism of L infinity algebras, which is much weaker than the usual one you would expect from universal algebra. And although this isn't, of course, the best way to write it, using the Chevalier-Eilenberg commutative algebra, it's a very effective way of explaining what's going on. So let me do that. So I want to describe what is a homotopy morphism of L infinity algebras. These are a version for L infinity algebras of what Stasheff and maybe Guggenheim and Stasheff introduced in the 60s, and in characteristic Stasheff style, he called them strongly homotopic maps or SHMAPs. So the idea was that they don't just have the first layer of homotopies, but they have homotopies all the way up. But when you, what it boils down to in this context, if we are interested in a, maybe I should write that. If we're interested in a morphism like this, it's actually given by a homomorphism of differential graded commutative algebras. This is at least under the additional hypothesis that L and M are finite dimensional. But we're going to unravel to some extent what this really means, and once we've done that, you can then adopt that definition in complete generality. So at least if M and L are finite dimensional. So, of course, the point is here that since the cochain algebra is a free commutative algebra, free graded commutative algebra, it suffices in looking at homomorphisms to restrict it to the generators and see what that equals on the generators. So, restricted to the generators, L, the desuspension of L dualized contained in here. Oops. Right. We may characterize this by the linear maps so the one of homogeneity N goes from this dual of L to the nth symmetric power of the dual of M. That is shifted, and so this is effectively the nth exterior power of the dual of M. And then, so F pullback restricted to the generators is then just the sum of these components. Now I can take the adjoint and I obtain graded symmetric operations from the mth tensor power of M to the lth tensor power of L. Taking the adjoint, we have Fn from M shifted in degree by 1 tensor power n to L shifted in degree by 1. These are graded symmetric. And after shifting the degrees around, we get maps from the nth tensor power of n to the nth tensor power of L of degree 1 minus n, which are graded antisymmetric now in n. I'm just going to be very, very confusing and use the same notation. So after shifting degrees around, we get degraded, anti-symmetric maps. Fn from the nth tensor power of m to L of degree 1 minus n. This is for n greater than 0. So maybe I should recall how this degree shift works. So recall that if alpha from L tensor n to m, let me do it in abstract. Recall that if we have a graded symmetric map alpha on the suspension of V, then it gives a graded anti-symmetric map alpha tilde from V tensor N to W of degree negative N by the formula alpha tilde of x1 up to xn is minus 1 to the n minus 1 times the degree of x1 plus n minus 2 times the degree of x2 plus dot 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 alpha x1 up to xn. So this allows you to shift back and forth between graded symmetric and graded anti-symmetric maps by shifting degree. Yeah. Well, another way of saying it is to put negative n here and erase that. Yeah. I chose to, write it in words. Okay. So this was just a review of something I went over quickly last time. So finally, we have these maps Fn, and F1 is just a morphism from M to L, and it's the sort of underlying linear part of the L-infinity map. But there are these higher corrections because F1 need not actually preserve the operations. It may only preserve the bracket up to a homotopy, and that homotopy is F2. So F1 is a cochain morphism which need not quite preserve the brackets, the bilinear bracket, but F2 yields a homotopy, and so on. So it seems to be a very good notion of tight notion of all the higher coherences for a morphism of L-infinity algebras. But you see that it just corresponds to an ordinary morphism of graded commutative algebras in the opposite direction, or if you prefer, we could and we should be using graded commutative coalgebras. And then there are no restrictions on finite dimensionality or so on, but I wanted to avoid coalgebras in these lectures. Okay, so now comes the punchline. This formula comes with a morphism from M to L. So there's, in fact, a canonical choice of morphism from M to L, with F1 just equal to I. So F1 is the inclusion of the subcomplex into L, but as we know from these formulas, this inclusion doesn't preserve the products, otherwise it would be very much easier to construct the L-infinite structure on M. But instead, there are higher pieces, and they're given by the same formulas. So let me state these. And this is on the shift of M, so I can avoid all those difficult signs. So the formula I'll give will be graded symmetric. And it's exactly the same formula. So same formula with J replaced by H. Which is good, because remember the degree of this operation is 2 minus n, whereas the degree of this is 1 minus n. It's one lower for the same n. And here what I've done is I've replaced J, which had degree 0, in the formula by H, which has degree negative 1. And so the degrees really do work out correctly. So this is, again, completely explicit. And I'm now going to use this. I'm going to define Morey-Cartan elements of an L-infinity algebra. And I'm going to use this map to transfer Morey-Cartan elements here to Morey-Cartan elements here, and I'm going to see what I get. So that's going to be the main result of the first part of the lecture. I'm sorry? Yes, but I don't actually know. There's an analogous construction for this subject for associative algebras, and there Markel has written a paper in which he does an explicit construction of an extension of J, but it's much less beautiful. It requires choices. So as for L infinity, there's a story here which has been explored by Markel and by Mekulov and Valette, and the idea is to use colored Kossel duality for operads. So if you do that, I think there's something, but I don't actually know. I've just got some notes from Valette which seem to explain something like this. So keep an eye out for papers by Mekulov and Valette. So I'm now going to make the following blanket assumption, that my L-infinite algebras are nilpotent. So by this, I mean that there's some filtration of the L-infinite algebra compatible with all the products such that the quotients are abelian. So there's a finite filtration L equals F1L containing F2L containing FNL containing n plus 1 L, which is 0, such that the bracket of Fi1 with Fin is contained in Fi1 plus 2In. So that's what I mean by a nilpotent L-infinity algebra. And with this assumption, I can write down the Morey-Cartan equation for an L-infinite algebra, this was somehow first written down, as I said, as far as I know, by these guys in supergravity. But you'll see that there are many examples. I'll give some examples of Murakata equations in a second, and you'll see that you've seen many different examples before in studying characteristic classes and so on. And then they were picked up by Kontsevich. So in his famous paper on formality for deformation quantization, he explicitly introduces the Murakata equation for L-infinite algebras. So last time, you'll recall, I motivated, maybe too briefly, the Murakata equation for a differential graded Lie algebra by saying that it's a deformation of the differential such that the new differential has square zero. So for L-infinite algebras, it's analogous, except all of the brackets deform. So here's how the formula goes. If we have an omega in L1, then we define a new differential, which is evaluated on x. It's dx plus the sum, n goes from 2 to infinity, 1 over, n goes from 1 to infinity, 1 over n factorial, and then omega repeated n minus, n times followed by x. Sorry, I think I got that right. Yeah. So we perform a kind of it's no longer a linear or affine deformation of the differential, but involves higher degree pieces. That's characteristic of what happens in an L-infinite algebra. And notice that because of my nilpotence assumption, this is actually a finite sum. So I don't have to worry about convergence. I could, of course, consider instead L-infinite algebras with complete filtrations, and then I could write this, but let me not do any topology. And now it's important to observe that you should deform the higher. Brackets as well. And the formula now it's as follows. So you see, the nth bracket is deformed by adding contributions from the nth, first the constant term in omega, which is just the nth bracket itself, and plus deformations, which involve the higher brackets. Now, in a differential graded Lie algebra, there are no higher brackets. So the deformation of the differential involves the bracket, and the deformation of the bracket involves nothing. And so the bracket doesn't move. But in L-infinite algebras, if I take an element of L1, I've moved, in general, all of the operations, except the top one. Okay? Yes, thank you. Yeah. So now we can ask, under what circumstances is this deformed structure still in L infinite algebra? And the answer is that that's the case if omega satisfies the Murakata equation. So, lemma, if f of omega, let me introduce this notion of curvature of a one form. It's d omega plus the sum n goes from 2 to infinity, 1 over n factorial, and then the nth bracket of omega with itself, if this equals 0, then the above deformation is again an L infinity algebra. So essentially what I'm advocating here is to modify your notion of what a connection is, what the Murakatan form is, and so on, in the presence of these L infinite phenomena by allowing higher degree pieces, not just quadratic pieces. And okay, so I'll introduce a symbol for the Murakatan set, denote by MCL the set of Murakatan elements. They all are in L1, so it's a subset of L1, and it's the set satisfying this equation. So this is actually a I guess it's an affine variety, at least if L1 is finite dimensional. But in these lectures, I'm going to tend to just think of it as a set. So I'll give some examples in a moment, but I want to state a couple of theorems first. Well, the first one is, well, this is more of a lemma, that if I have a morphism of L infinite algebras, that it carries the Murakatan set of one L infinite algebra into the Murakatan set of the other. So, lemma, let F from M to L be a morphism of L infinity algebras, and define for omega in L in M1, define F of omega to equal the sum from 1 to infinity of 1 over n factorial F n omega to omega. So notice, by the way, so Fn, remember, had degree 1 minus n. And each instance of omega has degree 1. And so the total degree of this thing is 1. So this is a homogeneous element in L1. And then the lemma is that if omega is a Murakatan element, then F of omega is a Murakatan element. Ah, don't confuse these two Fs. That's pretty stupid of me to have used both letters. So if omega is in Murakatan of M, then F omega is in Murakatan of L. Okay? So this is a very simple lemma. You can try at home to check it. It's obviously much easier if you can interpret a Murakatan element in terms of the Shevler-Allenberg complex. And then it should just, well, it should become, from the point of view of algebraic geometry, differential graded algebraic geometry completely obvious. So now I'm going to state my first new result of the lecture. And so this is, well, I'll call it a theorem just because I haven't seen it before. The statement is that I can identify in this context where I have this L infinite morphism F, I can identify the image of the set of Murakata elements of M. So notice that this map from Murakata elements of M to Murakata elements of L is going to be injective. And here's the theorem. F from M to L is an injection with image the set, so it's the set of Murakata elements of L such that H omega equals zero. So that's the main result. I can, because the L infinite structure on M is really very complicated, and so to understand what Murakata elements of M actually look like can be quite difficult. But if I apply this map F, which is quite explicit, to a Murakata element of M, I get, first of all, I know a priori by this lemma that I have a Murakata element of L, and now I can identify precisely which Murakata elements in L arise in this way. They're those which satisfy what I think of as a gauge condition. So I guess I think of Murakata elements as just flat connections, and I think of, so I'm thinking in terms of the space of connections satisfying this flatness condition, and then among those I take a slice, which is the which is those satisfying this side gauge condition. This is, I got into an argument with a referee on this question because the referee said that this is only a partial gauge condition. And I said, well, but in physics, I think partial gauge conditions arise also. So this, according to the referee, this would only be worthy of the name gauge condition if M had vanishing differential. Okay? So, however, maybe this is a good moment to mention that I'm not excluding that M does have vanishing differential. We can, of course, take M just to be the cohomology group, the graded cohomology of L, and pick for J and I just using a basis or some other method, some arbitrary injection. Or if you prefer, an example might be considering matrices of differential forms on a compact Riemannian manifold for L, and then matrices of cohomology classes for M with commutator as the bracket, and then using Hodge theory to define as H. And in that case, it would really be one of the gauges of actual electromagnetism. Well, on a Euclidean background. Okay, you had a question? No, this lemma is for that one. Above, yes, it's for any. Yes, the lemma is for any, Yeah, and this theorem is for that one. Yeah. Okay. So maybe I should mention that. Example. L equals K by K matrices of differential forms on a manifold X. So X is a compact Riemannian manifold. K is a natural number. And M is K by K matrices of harmonic forms and so I is just the inclusion of harmonic forms into all forms. J is the standard projection from a differential form to a harmonic form. And H is G composed with B adjoint, the usual contracting homotopy of Hodge theory. So in this case, I think the referee was happy to allow this to be called a gauge condition. But this is the sort of motivating example for why I call this a gauge condition, because this is, of course, somehow a bit similar to gauge conditions in electromagnetism. I have no idea. I'd like to meet the referee, but I actually asked the journal if the referee was willing to... But the journal didn't reply.
What is the bracket?
The bracket is just commutator, the graded commutator for both cases. Okay. Yeah. I should have maybe written not matrices, but little GL. Yeah. This is not meant to be a useful example. It's just to illustrate what's going on. No. N is nilpotent, but L isn't. Yeah. Yeah, so there's a little problem with L. But one way to get rid of that problem is to throw away the zero forms completely. The only reason that I'm having problems here is from the zero forms, and they don't occur in discussing Morricarton elements, so it's somehow not so much a problem. But by the time you take the harmonic forms, then you're okay, because now the degree zero part is central, and so... Oh, no, that's not true. Shoot, there's a little GL... No, so it's not nilpotent in any way. I take it back. But it doesn't matter. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Obviously, I'm avoiding all of that. Exactly. And that's the problem with this whole discussion. Yeah. So. Very, very perturbative. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So. Now I need to give the example of this setup, which I'm really interested in today. So I think this will run over beyond the end of this half of the lecture, but let me get started. So this construction is due to Whitney and DuPont, And essentially now we're going to do a little numerical analysis. What we're going to do is study differential forms on manifolds through differential forms on simplicial complexes. And Whitney, I suppose, began this study. And so he introduced a class of differential forms on the simplex which have the very nice property that they give an explicit incarnation of the simplicial cochain on the n-simplex. So Whitney defined natural inclusions of complexes. Remember last time I had the normalized simplicial cochains on the n-simplex, which were spanned by the chains supported on the different geometric faces, obtained by taking non-empty subsets of the vertices. And there's an inclusion into differential forms on the n-simplex. So the question arises, which version of differential forms do I have in mind? And here, well, the answer is, to some extent, you can use any definition, because all of these the image of the inclusion will just be differential forms having affine coordinates, affine coefficients. So they're not, so any reasonable class of differential forms would admit those with affine coefficients. Notice the image is certainly not going to be a subalgebra, but it is a homotopy equivalence. And what DuPont did was give a canonical contracting homotopy of the image. So I'll give you this construction explicitly. If you want to know a sort of more explicitly what sort of differential forms I have in mind here, I could either take C infinite coefficients, and we're very familiar with such differential forms. Of course, I have to define for you what I mean by C-infinite coefficients on a manifold with corners. And so the usual definition is that they should extend into some neighborhood of the n-simplex inside Rn. And the other definition, which is much simpler for handling algebraically, is the one which I guess was introduced by René Thom and then was used with great effect by Sullivan in his work on rational homotopy. And here we can take, whereas with smooth coefficients we're stuck with the ground ring containing R, when we go to polynomial coefficient differential forms we can actually take the ground field to be the rational numbers. And what we do is we take polynomials in the homogeneous coordinates T0 up to TN as our coefficients. I'm just beginning here. So we tensor this with an exterior algebra. Whoops. So here I have N plus 1 exterior generators, and they're all placed in degree 1. You can think of this as a sub-algebra of the smooth differential forms, if you like. And then I have to impose some relations, because these coordinates, maybe I should explain that I'm realizing the simplex here as the convex hull of the unit vectors in Rn plus 1. And so I'm considering coefficients such that the Ti are all positive and their sum is equal to 1. Well, when we have polynomial coefficients, we can forget about the positivity condition, because any polynomial coefficient will extend to all of the linear span of the simplex. And so what we're left with is just the relations are that the sum of the ti equals 1, and if I take the differential of this relation, that the sum of the dti equals 0. So this realization of differential forms on the n-simplex is definitely, if you haven't seen it before, it's definitely worth becoming comfortable with, because it's so easy to use. So now, Whitney defines a projection from differential forms to normalized from differential forms to normalized cochains. So let me define J first. And it's this map where we need characteristic zero. Because, of course, to integrate polynomials, we need characteristic zero. The integral of a polynomial in general is a rational number. So the definition is simply you integrate. So if you have a face spanned by some vertices, you take this differential form and you restrict it to that face, and now you just take the standard Riemann integral. Of course, if the differential forms are polynomial, then you can write down the explicit algebraic formula for this construction. So if we have vertices I0 up to ik contained in 0n, so these span a k-simplex in the n-simplex, then what we're doing is taking the integral over this span. So restriction of omega to this k-simplex. And you should worry a bit about the signs, but if I just assume that these are always in ascending order, then basically this map is just the collection of all of these rational numbers. Okay, so that's J, and then Whitney discovered a section of this projection, and it's given by the following formula. So, given a set of indices inside 0 up to n, let's define a differential form. It'll be a k-form by the following explicit formula. What am I doing here? Notice it's a k form. This would have been a k plus 1 form, but I'm leaving out one of the factors. And there are k plus 1 terms, in each of which one of the differentials is replaced by the corresponding coordinate. And then we take these with alternating sign. And for the moment, this k factorial is maybe mysterious, but recall that k factorial is the volume of the k simplex. Sorry, what did I say? 1 over k factorial is the volume of the k simplex. And so now, because of this normalization, we have the following. Statement is that the integral of this elementary form over one of the k-dimensional faces of the n-simplex is 1 if we have the same indices and 0 otherwise. So this really does give you a section of this projection equals 1 or 0. I0 equals J0 up to IK equals JK and 0 otherwise. So these differential forms define thus a subcomplex of all the differential forms which realize the cohomology. And let me give you a couple of formulas involving them.
Yeah.
Simplicial. No? Differential forms is contravariant. Yeah. So, okay, that's a good property. Thank you. Okay. So, in fact, you can check that it's true. What you need to do is look at this formula and see what happens. The simplicial maps are just given by renumbering the indices according to the map, and you can see that the formula is invariant under such a... So that's a way of saying that both the differential forms on the n-simplex, this is a simplicial differential graded commutative algebra. Likewise, the normalized cochains, I'm just going to consider it as a simplicial cochain complex. So then I and J are simplicial. That is, they are compatible with all the simplicial structure maps here and here. So in other words, essentially restriction to faces. There's also the degeneracies, but the most important ones are if you restrict to a face, then I and J are compatible with that restriction. And compatible with the differentials. But not with the product. The products. I don't want to consider the standard product on shoot, what's that called? The usual product. Cut product. It's got a name. Something to do with Whitney? Is Whitney his name? Sorry? Alexander Whitney. Yeah, that's right. So anyway, I don't want to consider that because it's not commutative, and so it won't fit into these lectures. And let me just finish then with... So compatible with the differential boils down to saying that the differential of this differential form is given by a sum of elementary forms with that formula, where I have to reorder these if you want to bring them into normal ordering. If I is equal to any of these indices, I get 0. So it's an it's some sort of alternating sum of such differential forms. Okay, so I'll recommence in 5 minutes. microphone. So now I've put on the microphone. Then omega is a sum omega A tensor EA, where omega A is just a one form on the N simplex. And then the Morikawa equation just says that d omega A plus C A B C 1/2. Oops, this isn't going to work. A B C omega A wedge omega B is 0, where these are the structure coefficients, except I've written them upside down. So this is then an equation for two forms. So that's the usual case. But now let's go to some more interesting examples of L-infinite algebras. So the first example I want to give is the Hochschild cochains. So let's take an associative algebra A, and then L, I'm going to define a differential graded Lie algebra where LK will equal linear maps from the K plus first tensor power of A to A. So these are the Hochschild cochains. So notice that for k equals 0, we just have endomorphisms of A. And that, of course, is a Lie algebra with respect to commutator. And Gerstenhaber generalized that bracket to multilinear maps. So essentially, if you have multilinear maps on a vector space, you already have a graded Lie algebra. And then the associative product on A defines a bracket. I'm sorry, defines a differential. So the Gerstenhaber bracket, x bracket y, is, so it's the sum with suitable signs essentially of these guys. So you insert, and now I'm doing my trees in antipodal fashion again. You insert the multi operation y into successively each of the inputs of x with alternating signs, minus the same thing, well, minus or plus, depending on the grading, the same thing with the roles reversed. So there are some complicated signs, but it's not hard to get them straight. And the differential so we take mu in L1, which is the associative product, and then it turns out that mu satisfies the, it's a sort of Morikawa equation, its bracket with itself is 0 with respect to this bracket, and we take the Hochschild differential d equals add mu, the graded commutator with mu. because of this formula, you see that d squared is 0. Well, this isn't a nilpotent L-infinity algebra, so I should fix that by replacing L by something nilpotent. So make L nilpotent by tensoring with, well, I don't know what my ground ring is. Let's make it C with polynomials truncated to order n, and with the same, just extend the bracket and differential. And then we see the Murakata elements of this L, so let's call this Ln, the Murakata elements of Ln are just the same thing as deformations of the product. So the Murakata elements are precisely the truncated series which are associative up to order n plus 1. Okay. So now, this is a nice reference example, and I can insert this differential graded Lie algebra into this construction, and the reason I wanted to do that is to see what effect having positive degree elements in the L infinite algebra has on this construction. So for little n equal to 0, I've identified what my set, mu, the original mu. Maybe I'll fix that by just calling this mu zero. Okay, so let's try to see what so for n equal to 1, let's think about what a Murakata form will be for this Ln. So we'll have a zero form component . The total degree has to be 1, so this will be a element of zero forms on the one simplex tensored with a degree 1 element of this differential graded Lie algebra. And this, of course, is, in other words, a polynomial in the coordinate on the one simplex with values in this. So call the coordinate on the one simplex S. Maybe S is a really bad idea. Call it tau, just so I don't confuse it with any of the other things kicking around. So this is T1. In terms of the previous notation. And so what we have now is mu zero plus T mu one of T of tau plus up to T n mu n of tau plus o to the t n plus 1. So it's a polynomial coefficient, one parameter family of deformations of the original product on A. And so, and then we have another piece, which is a one form with values in L0 of n. What is L0? L0 is endomorphisms of A. So actually what it's going to be is I'm going to be considering the inner derivations write that as nu tau equals t nu 1 tau plus t to the n nu n tau plus o t to the n plus 1. And what do the Morakato equations say? Well, there's a zero form component. And that just says that mu of tau is in the Morakato set for each tau. So we have a one parameter formal deformation of the product. On A. And what about the one form component of the Morakato equation? So there'll be two pieces. One is the Durham differential applied to the zero form piece, and the Durham differential in one dimension is just taking a derivative with respect to tau. So we have d mu tau by d tau. And then the other piece is the Gerstenhaber bracket of nu with mu. That says that this sum is zero. And another way of thinking about this is that mu is moving under this, if you want to think of this as a infinitesimal rotation of A, because it's in it's an endomorphism of A, and so it generates a rotation of A, which rotates mu of tau into mu of tau plus epsilon. So what in some sense this is saying is that we have a homotopy of Morakato elements. So this is a polynomial homotopy of Morakato elements. Well, you can play with this in higher dimensions. Actually, the only dimension in which, in some sense, it's worth trying to see what happens after this point is the 2-simplex. When you go to the 2-simplex, you'll discover an interesting phenomenon that you'll get a 2-form contribution to the Morakato element. And that will involve the negative 1-degree part of this Lie algebra, which is just an element of A. And so what we get is that there's additional components in the Morakato equation which correspond to considering rotations which are in fact given by inner automorphisms. So this is of course clearly somewhat related to constructing some two-groupoid. We're sort of working towards a two-groupoid in which the Morakato elements are the objects. Some sort of homotopies are the morphisms, and these inner automorphisms are the two morphisms. And now I want to use my formalism with the DuPont homotopy to make that a precise statement, that there's a two-groupoid hiding here. So let me first, and let me re-emphasize, this is all under the assumption that L is nilpotent. So let me state a theorem, which is essentially due to Hinich. I don't think he quite states it this generally, but it's more or less what he says. So N goes to, let me introduce the abbreviation MCN for this Maurer-Cartan set. This is a Kahn complex. Okay. So let me just mention, Hinich calls this sigma of L, the nerve of L. Okay. So a Kahn complex is, after all, then a homotopy type. And what is this homotopy type? This is a rational space, which is the rational space which Quillen associated to at least a differential graded Lie algebra. Actually, in his paper, he considers differential graded commutative coalgebras and associates to them a rational homotopy type. And you see then that in a sense he is including L-infinite algebras, because L-infinite algebras give rise to a subclass of differential graded commutative coalgebras. And let me mention something which will be important to me later. So note. So first of all, this construction somehow doesn't really care about the positive degree part of L. And there's a way around that, which is to work with differential graded sheaves. And use work in some infinity topos, but I've decided not to do that, especially since I don't know how to work in that field. But you can translate all of this into the language of infinity topoi using a site which is just not nilpotent algebras, but nilpotent differential graded commutative algebras. So you can explore the rest of the L-infinite algebra, but let me ignore that. So this construction only sees Li for I less than or equal to 2. And it barely sees L2. It only needs it as a location for where the Maurer-Cartan equation for elements in L1 land. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we can consider this restricted to those L-infinite algebras which are vanishing in positive degree. If Li equals 0, I greater than 0, then MC0L, which is, of course, the Maurer-Cartan set of L, is 0. It's just a single point, so we get a reduced Kahn complex. And what else should I observe then? If L is truncated below, so if in addition Li equals 0 for I less than or equal to negative n, then pi I of MCL equals 0 for I greater than n. So I guess a connected rational n-type. A connected rational nilpotent n-type, by which I just mean a homotopy type which is truncated. It has no non-trivial homotopy groups for I greater than n. And so I want to realize this instead, this n type, as an n groupoid. Because somehow there's an ideology that the best way to realize homotopy n types is as n groupoids. So I'm just going to take a rather slack approach to this. I'm more or less going to say, well, we have a Kahn complex. We can consider its Postnikov tower. And there are various canonical realizations of a Postnikov tower. And I'm going to pick one of them and declare an n-groupoid to be something whose such that the nth space in its Postnikov tower is equal to itself. So such that the Postnikov tower is constant above a certain point. So I'll just declare that that's what an n-groupoid is. The reason I'm going to do that is my construction will give such a answer automatically. So let me explain that. By the way, this is intimately related to the Dold-Kahn theorem. If L is abelian, then the homotopy type I'm getting is homotopy equivalent to the one given by the Dold-Kahn theorem. But it uses differential forms, not cochains, as in the Dold-Kahn theorem. And so now I'm going to correct that by projecting back down to simplicial cochains. And in that way, I'll get a construction which will agree with the Dold-Kahn construction, but will work for general L-infinite algebras. So I want to consider this L-infinite algebra. I'm going to take now the normalized simplicial cochains on the n-simplex tensored with L. So this is just a direct sum of a finite number of translated, of shifted copies of L. For example, if n is 1, this is just two copies of L plus a suspension of L. So it's not too large. And of course, by everything I've said, this is made in a canonical way into an L-infinite algebra using the DuPont contracting homotopy. The point, what is the point? It's one of the points, but it wasn't the main one in my mind. The main one in my mind was going to be what's coming next. I'm going to run this program in this example, and we'll see that something happens which is very pleasant. Okay, so I now applied my main theorem from the first half, which was that we can identify this Morricarton set with those Morricarton elements in the original, in MCN of L, which satisfy the side condition that the DuPont homotopy vanishes on. So this is isomorphic by that explicit formula from the first half of the lecture with the set of Morricarton forms. So this is that set at the top of the board there, such that S omega equals zero. So we'll call this the DuPont gauge. Okay. Now, because the DuPont contracting homotopy is simplicial, it turns out all of these sets assemble to form a simplicial set as you vary n. So let me give that a name. Since the Dold-Kahn construction is often called capital gamma, I chose to call this little gamma. So I warn you, in the paper that I have on the archive about this subject, I only write down this realization of this simplicial set. I don't yet have this formulation of it in that paper. So this is a simplicial set. And I can, because L is nilpotent, I can prove a number of results about it. In particular, it's included into the Morricarton Kahn complex, and I proved that's a homotopy equivalence. So this guy is capturing the same homotopy as the Morricarton simplicial set, the nerve of Hinich. So let's see how that works over here. So what does the DuPont gauge look like? Let me do that here. So I can't answer that question in general. It's too complicated. But on zero forms, well, the DuPont gauge maps zero forms to minus one forms. So it's, of course, no restriction at all on the zero form component. In top degree, by contrast, it turns out that it forces the differential form to be constant. And so the DuPont gauge is somehow, it's interpolating between no restriction in degree zero and maximal restriction in top degree. So let's go back to the one-dimensional case and see what the DuPont gauge does for us here. Well, it's obvious that the only condition it imposes is that nu is now constant. And so the data of a one simplex in this simplicial set is that we have mu of tau, a polynomial coefficient element of the Morricarton set, so a polynomial deformation of the original associative product, and in addition, an endomorphism of the algebra, nu. Which, of course, so it depends. Okay. DuPont gauge. It makes nu of tau equal nu independent of tau. So it's constant on the one simplex. So that modifies the equation here to this one. And now we see that mu of tau is actually uniquely determined by its value at any value of tau and nu. So we've cut down considerably the dimension of our space. And so the one simplices are in fact just determined by mu of zero and nu. And this, if you recall, this is endomorphisms of A. And what you can prove is that endomorphisms of A tensored with truncated polynomials. I should put a capital N here. Right. So what you can prove is in fact that this simplicial set that I've introduced using the DuPont gauge is naturally isomorphic to the nerve of the groupoid given by allowing the group, which is associated to this nilpotently algebra, to act on this set. Because the action is obtained simply by evaluating the results of solving this ODE at tau equals 1. And so you can continue that to higher dimensions. That will be what I'll do next time, and then link this up with higher groupoids. So this is the first... I'm sorry, I've said that wrong. Actually, you get a two-groupoid in this example, so that's going to be the main result of the first part of my lectures next time. So what we have here is the group associated to the nilpotently algebra LN0 is acting on the Morey-Cartan set, and in fact we will see that we get gamma of LN equals the nerve of a two-groupoid. And the underlying a two-groupoid is a one-groupoid where you just forget the two morphisms, and that one-groupoid will just be the action groupoid for this group acting on this set. So let me state a bunch of theorems. So the first is that gamma L is a Kahn complex. The inclusion of gamma L into the nerve of L is a homotopy equivalence. If Li equals 0, I less than or equal to negative n, then gamma L is the nerve of a weak n groupoid. Okay. So, of course, this depends on us knowing what weak N groupoids are, and I actually, in some sense, only know that for N up to 2. And so for N up to 2, the notion nerve of a weak N groupoid somehow agrees with what I already know. But I can, I'm going to use a characterization due to Duskin of what the nerves of weak N groupoids look like. We don't know what N groupoids are, but we do know what their nerves are by Duskin. And I'm going to actually check that gamma satisfies that condition. Okay, so I think I should stop there.